Thanks very much, Ted. As I said, we've circulated a table, and I think the first thing to note is that we've got essentially three parts to the table, because the first three headings there, FICA, Banking Association, and NEDLAC, those are, as the committee requested yesterday, they'll also provide a sense of where there were comments during the public comment and consultation process that were taken into account in the final draft. And, so that's just to get a sense of some of the discussions that took place prior to the tabling of the bill. And so that's why you won't have seen written submissions on those issues. It's in fact only the next one, Standard Bank, was the only party that submitted a written comment to the committee. And then right at the end, we also have a section on specific issues raised by the committee yesterday for us to respond to today. So if I can start with the comments that were received and discussed beforehand. Firstly, there was some engagement with FICA, which is the African Institute of Chartered Accountants, around Section 17 on the Audit Committee. There was some concern raised about the requirement that only non-executives may serve on the Audit Committee, because there was a view that there are perhaps too few skilled candidates available in the South African context, too few skilled non-executives, and that skilled executives should be allowed to serve on these committees. And that was an opinion that was expressed by FICA. There was some discussion around this, and essentially the point was made that the requirement that you only have non-executives is in fact consistent with international international standards and best practice. Members will be aware of a lot of the debates around the Enron scandal and Sarbanes-Oxley in the US. It's essentially these debates around proper corporate governance and the fact that as soon as you have executives involved in an audit committee, you have the seeds of conflict of interest. And so there was some discussion around that, and there was eventual agreement from FICA that would be the way to go. Although we will come back to discuss this issue actually again a bit later under the Standard Bank comments. Then moving on to the Banking Association, there was some discussion that took place during the Standing Committee review process, which was subsequently resolved, which was around the power of the registrar to impose penalties. I think there was some concern expressed initially about the amount of the maximum penalty and what the remedies would be available to aggrieved parties. Now, this we were able to sort out. As we've indicated, the 10 million rand is an absolute maximum penalty, and we feel it's appropriate given the financial size and position of banks. And it was also made clear that there are remedies available to the aggrieved party in the form of due process. There's a board of review of the process, there's an appeal from the minister, and finally there's also the review by the court. So those issues were resolved. I should actually realize we haven't included this, but we should mention, and we did touch on it briefly yesterday, that there was a written submission by the Banking Association to the committee that was sent through, I think, on Friday last week, which was subsequently withdrawn. Might be helpful for me to explain a bit of the background there. It was the Section 79, I think, which is not a Basel II requirement, but it's actually something dealing with the funding of banks. But what actually happened was there was a bit of confusion between what's actually in the legislation versus what would be contained in the regulation. What the legislation does is it broadens the range of short-dated funding instruments that the Reserve Bank should be able to have some control over in terms of the funding method. So, in fact, the legislation only broadens the enabling provision in the legislation. So there was some misunderstanding with the discussions that are still ongoing around the regulations, which will decide the actual limits of short-dated funding, were being brought into the legislative amendment. So there was, I think, some confusion amongst the people within the Banking Association who commented on the distinction between the ongoing regulatory discussions versus the enabling provision in the legislation. So that was subsequently withdrawn by the Banking Association once it was clarified. And then, as mentioned, NEDBAC comments. This just relates to some of the issues we touched on yesterday around general issues relating to the impact on access to finance and affordability. And as I discussed yesterday, these were the factors that were specifically assessed as part of the study on the economic impact of Basel II. And as it was said, the assessment found that Basel II is not expected to have significant impact on bank pricing decisions or access to finance, and that in fact the latter is governed more by the financial sector charter commitments, and banks made it clear that they made these commitments in terms of the charter in full knowledge of the probable imminent implementation of Basel II, and therefore Basel II is not any excuse for them to alter their commitment to those targets. And then just lastly to mention, there is also flexibility provided for specific risk mitigating factors allowed in terms of national discretion items which are contained in regulation. So that covers the issues that were raised during the process and were resolved as part of the process. There were 5 comments from Standard Bank, and I think we'll explain that most of them are actually not relevant to the amendments. The first one deals with the abolition of par value shares and nominal value in the company's bill. And perhaps I won't read through the entire comment there, but essentially the Standard Bank was saying they are aware that in the upcoming company's bill there are recommendations of the abolition of the concept of par value shares and nominal value, and that this would be in conflict with the current Section 79 of the Bank Act, which states that the bank shall not issue shares of no par value. Now, the problem with that comment is obviously the company is still referred to, it's still in draft form, and still subject to amendments and public comments. The DTI indicates that it's envisaged that the draft law will actually only be tabled in 2008. So the problem is we don't agree that one can make amendments to the Bank Act in anticipation or sort of prejudging what the legislature will actually decide on this issue. So I think the Standard Bank is a little bit incorrect in that regard. But we are saying one once the company bill has become a company's act, then one can revisit the issue of alignment. And then the next issue comes back to the issue of the audit committee. Essentially, Standard Bank is raising a similar issue. And again, Bank is raising the issue that the Bank Act is not fully aligned with the indications of where the company's bill is going. Again, the company's bill is still in draft form, and in fact, exactly the same response applies. Then moving on to Section 17, Directors Affairs Committee. Firstly, the amendment, the section talks about the Directors Affairs Committee, which will have the role of ensuring the bank or controlling company, as the case may be, is at all times in compliance with all applicable laws, regulations, and codes of conduct and practice. And Standard Bank is saying that they're concerned that the scope of the duties of the Directors Affairs Committee is broad and needs to be limited to ensure there's no overlap with the responsibilities of other board committees, such as the Audit and Risk Committees. Our response is that we're a little confused by the comment in that we actually see no overlap with the Audit Committee or the Risk Committee, as the amendment refers specifically to all applicable laws. And then the next issue deals with liquid assets as it relates to gold, coin, and bullion. Now there's a whole long comment there which essentially boils down to saying, some banks do hold gold, coins, and bullion, and there's concerns that the part that talks about held in the Republic may be restricted because a lot of them hold their gold in London, for instance. And whilst there's a lot of valid points for discussion in the comment, the short answer is that actually this comment is a bit irrelevant because it doesn't actually refer to an amendment that is being brought into the Banks Act. The tabled amendment bill does not propose any amendment to Section 72 of the Banks Act. It seems what Standard Bank has done is sort of thrown in a wish list of things that they would like to see changed in the Banks Act, rather than commenting on a specific amendment. But it should be noted that National Treasury and the Registrar of Banks are currently reviewing some of these issues with respect to aspects relating to liquid assets. But there's still a policy process going on there, and the outcome, and only once we have the outcome of that review, will that inform possible future amendments to the Banks Act. So the Standard Bank has sort of jumped the gun a little bit on that issue. And then lastly, there's references to other acts, Canada is saying references to other legislation may soon be redundant. And basically the response is that all references to legislation were amended were appropriate, but we weren't going to change references to proposed legislation until such time or if such that were promulgated. And then I tend to respond to some of the specific issues raised by the committee yesterday, and if there's, and obviously we can follow that up through the discussion if the responses haven't covered all the aspects of the question. There was a question around gold held with the reserve bank. And the first point here is to say that there's currently no legal provision that requires banks to hold a possessorship of their assets in gold. That obviously was part of the system when one was on the gold standard. Under the current system, that's no longer a requirement. Just to mention that where banks do own gold, they may keep it wherever they deem appropriate. It's the current provision. Under the new system, how it works is that banks are required to hold and maintain a minimum amount of cash, which they have to hold as a deposit with the SARB, and that's equal to 2.5 times its total liabilities. And then there was another question dealing with the link between liquidations and reckless lending by banks. Our reading of the question was to say, percent. I thought so. I've just been corrected by the comment. That should actually say equal to 2.5% of its total liabilities. Otherwise, we would have a lot of cash in the reserve bank. That should be half should be a percent. Was it 2.5%? Yes. Yeah, well, actually, it's a way to take cash out of the system rather than rent. I think the banks would be a little bit shocked if it goes to 2.5%. So 2.5% of its total liability. And then on the last issue, I think related to the question of the issues of whether reckless lending by banks was causing liquidation in the South African economy. The first point to note is that, as we discussed yesterday, the Basel II provisions themselves won't have any direct impact on bank lending practices. The banks continue to be able to apply their lending practices as current. But of course, lending practices and particularly control and reckless lending are addressed in the National Credit Act. Although it should be noted that the NCA only covers lending to individuals and not companies. However, we should add that indirectly, Basel II provisions should actually assist in reducing reckless lending in that it will introduce more risk-sensitive capital charges and possibly offer more risk-sensitive pricing behavior. So certainly it should make banks more sensitive to the issues of reckless lending and possibly plus lending. We did try to get statistics on liquidation, as I think was requested yesterday. Just to note, those aren't reported to the registrar, but rather to the Master of the High Court. We did try to get hold of the statistics from the Master's office, but weren't successful by this morning. But we will certainly forward that to the committee members once we've obtained that information. Thank you.
There we are. Responses to comments, both from the submissions or and also the committee's session.
Mine is a broad comment. There's some bit of broad question. I do support the approach of National Treasury and the Reserve Bank on the issue of all the policies to ensure that indeed all the policies are independent. Because I believe the independence of all the policies can start to strengthen good corporate governance in South Africa. My question, I mean, might not be directly related to this. I know at one stage the banking supervision division of the Reserve Bank is conducting effects on corporate governance in South Africa. I know it might be diverging a bit from our discussion now. In your slide where you specify that banks are upholding standards of good corporate governance. If not, are there any areas that should be given attention?
Thank you, Jim. Given the fact that the submission referred to the company's vote, and you have responded back to this saying that interpretation is irrelevant. Now, I know for a fact that outside there a number of people are anticipating and wondering, you know, when this act is going to come into being. Now, first of all, I know it's not in, you know, your responsibility, but you have an idea. How long has it been a draft in draft form? Because this is really concerned. A lot of people are getting a bit confused. And it's not your responsibility to have to comment on it. It's the major point that the role players outside way are concerned that it's taking too long. The comment on the bank, the goal, and the surplus there of the 2.5%, I think you have, in a nutshell, you have explained to me clearly, you know, what's my concern there. So thanks. If there's any more you wish to add, you know, I'd like to hear about it. Thank you.
I'm trying to get some better clarity on the very last point linked between implementation and right of standards. The second last sentence says, yesterday when we asked this question, we were given an answer that basically talked to the fact that rather others who will give more, if I recall that story, will give more favor to those who are borrowing. In other words, this will not impact negatively to the borrowers. Of course, it also does mention, as you were informed, history, the fact that you are certainly going to increase more risk for those, you know, on the higher risk sectors of any borrowing. I'm struggling to come to terms. Here, for me, a more simplified, you know, the answer to this would be talking more about a need to either reduce or increase. But if you are to increase, it does the opposite. If you are to increase any charges, and here is mentioning more risk-sensitive than certain charges, possibly, and possible pricing behavior. If you would clarify on that one. The very last point I wanted clarity on, is this by law but these statistics on liquidation are not reported to, or are only adhered to the matter of course that we have to access them through. There is no way of sharing of the data or information from any central point wherein you are in, without really having to submit any legal papers.
I will ask my colleagues to respond to the question regarding the audit committee. Well, in fact, the point was made about the audit committee, and the question actually related to the study assessment of corporate governance direct transaction. One of you can respond to that. And then similarly, if you would like to add anything to the response on the gold, on the holding the gold question. And then lastly, also the question regarding the reporting statistics on liquidation in terms of legislation. Is it restricted to marks of the High Court? But before I ask to do that, I think I'll just come in on two of the questions. I must confess I don't know exactly the details around how long the company saw it in draft form. I do know it has been a somewhat extensive process. I know it was done in two phases. There was the first phase being some amendments to the company law, and which I think was promulgated last year, but the total, the rewrite is certainly taking a little bit longer. And the Office of the Accountant General in the National Treasury is engaging with the DCI on that issue. And then I'll try to discuss the points around Article 2 and the impact on pricing and risk lending and risk decline. And I think the point there is, I think how we looked at the issue is that reckless lending, in a sense, would be giving credit or loans to parties where they are not in a good position to service those loans. And in many cases, this is what leads companies, and not only companies, but also individuals down the road to a debt trap. Certainly for individuals, it leads to a debt trap and being blacklisted with credit bureaus, for instance. With companies, on the other hand, you have situations where credit is being extended, where there's not necessarily the capacity to service that loan, and that can potentially lead companies down the path of being forced into a liquidation position. So I think there is an important link between the lending practices of banks and the issues of liquidation. As you said, that is dealt with specifically reckless lending in the National Credit Act. But where I think the second part of the response comes in is that Basel II also, in a sense, requires the banks to take a very serious look at whether the party that they're lending to is able to sustain that lending, because they have to do a proper risk assessment. And I think what we're saying is we see that as a big improvement, because previous bank practices were and let's be honest, general models applied historically were, well, we don't really have the information, we're not going to really put a lot of effort into trying to gain the information, and especially in the areas, for instance, the black SMEs, this is a grey area that we know nothing about, and we're not really going to put particular effort into learning more about it, because we can earn all the money we like on the higher end of the market. So traditionally, I think it's fair to say that banking in South Africa largely ignored the greater majority of the market, and especially areas like black SMEs lending. That is turning around through things like the financial sector charter, and certainly our assessment is that Basel II assists this process, because now banks are placed in the position where they have to undertake more specific assessments of the types of clients they have, and to actually collect information on the performance of those loan assets. And what that means is we suspect in the past that because banks didn't have a lot of information about these sectors, they took a very conservative approach. They said, well, we don't know much about this sector, so we're going to assume the worst about this sector, and we're going to assume that this is a risky area, and we're going to price appropriately for that. Now, what Basel II will help with is saying, you now actually have to go about doing a proper assessment of this market and price accordingly. And I think what that will do is it will help to reduce reckless lending, because now banks will be more aware of where there could be risky lending, which is not helpful for the bank, because then they have non-performing loans, but it's also not helpful for the companies who receive the loans, because they end up in a position where they can't service the debt and are forced down a liquidation route. And then if I can hand over to Saab on the other issue.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Yes, I can confirm that during 2002-2003, Bank Supervision Commission, an independent study of the five biggest banks, an advocate, Myberg, AC, completed a study and a report back to the Bank Supervision Department concerning that the big five banks were indeed compliant with Team 1 and Team 2 recommendations on corporate governance, and that they were really well in compliance with those recommendations. Thereafter, in 2004-2005, Bank Supervision Commission undertook an in-house on-site review of the rest of the banking sector, and those reports came back also very positive, that corporate governance in those smaller banks were indeed of a high standard, although concerns were raised regarding the composition of the board and the skills level of the board members. Those have been obviously taken up with specific banks to upgrade and train directors of boards. Thank you.
Maybe on the issue of gold, South Africa, like many other central banks in the world, actually uses a system of fiat money. What this actually means is that in the past, there was always an underlying asset that actually was held in accordance with the issue of paper. So in other words, if notes are issued, you always had to hold gold specifically, a percentage of gold to underline the issue of the bankrupt, but this has now gone away, and it's developed to the stage to use fiat money. Nothing underwrites this. It's based on the economy itself. The Reserve Bank at specific times during the course of the year actually calculates how much funding will be needed in the economy for a year, and then actually the banknotes are issued then. What happened in the past under the system then where gold was held is that on the note there was something that said, I promise to pay. And if a person took this note to the South African Reserve Bank, technically speaking, I mean, that little portion of gold would actually be calculated, and I don't know how big it would have been, in accordance with the rand, for example, but then the person, technically speaking, would have been able to exchange the notes for gold. This is no longer possible. What will happen is, or what has happened is that the Act now actually declares that banknotes are officially legal tender, so when a person actually presents a banknote as payment to any person, the person on the other side cannot refuse to take the money because it's legal tender. So what will happen in these circumstances, if you have a soiled banknote, you can actually take the soiled banknote to the South African Reserve Bank and it will be exchanged for a new one. But the Reserve Bank is not obliged to change under circumstances. It provides for these circumstances where you can actually guard against money laundering, which you can take soiled banknotes and exchange it. Anything else?
Okay, so the funds from the statistics on liquidation.
But Mr. Chairperson, the problem is with these statistics, the Bank Supervision Department and the South African Reserve Bank, not being the functionary in this, will not have these statistics. The statistics are kept properly with the government department, and I think it's the master of the Supreme Court, and that information will be available there. I'm not quite sure if that information is made public knowledge. I'm not sure about that. I would myself think that they would bring out a report or something on a yearly basis that will actually provide this. I'm not sure.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, there is such a report. I have seen reports on that report in the press from time to time, so there is definitely such a report. Both on companies as well, company liquidations as well as personal laws and registration as well.
Just to add that is the case, and that is the information we're seeking for to provide to the members once we manage to obtain.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman. Perhaps if I can just make a general comment. If there's a number of the questions that have been raised by the members, there is one concept that might assist, if I could just for a moment just take the concept of capital and just talk for a minute on that. Essentially what I just want to say is that if one capital constitutes the basis of economic development, and the amount of capital at any point in time in an economic system is finite, it is highly important, therefore, that that capital is well applied, is well allocated. If the capital is destroyed, then the next moment there will be less capital available in the economy, and consequently those economic participants in that economy will be less well off. However, if that capital is well allocated and achieves a return, that a high return, then by implication the amount of capital in that economy rises to the general benefit of all the participants in that economy. So it is vitally important that capital is well allocated. That is a very fundamental principle. Capital has to be safeguarded and has to be applied in the most productive manner possible, taking into account the risk. quick follow-up on that. Obviously, one must remember that capital is not necessarily equal to cash. So in that more broader definition of capital, yeah, and in line with it.
The absence of further questions. I see you have circulated a two-pager with some amendments. Would you like to talk to that?
Thank you, Chair. It's in fact a very, it's just a really a restructuring of one of the clauses, and the state law advisor, the sister, does with this, because there was some concern that the old wording might be a little bit confusing, and essentially, if I can make sure I have the right. It's clause 17 and it's 990. Currently 64.2 reads the functions of the audit committee shall be to assist the board of directors, and then it lists a whole lot of issues, of areas that will assist them. And then the problem was that when you get to D, it reads to perform such further functions as may be prescribed. So if one takes it from the top, it's basically saying the functions of the audit committee shall be to assist the board of directors to perform such further functions as may be prescribed. Now the concern was that by saying such further functions as may be prescribed, that may be misread as applying to the board of directors rather than to the audit committee. So the amendment simply clarifies that, and now it reads, the proposal reads that the audit committee shall, and then A is assist the board of directors with various issues. Which is pretty much, which is exactly the same as the bill that was tabled, but because the numbers have changed, there's a few changes required, and then goes on to say, B, perform such further functions as may be prescribed, which makes it clearer that that description applies to the audit. And this is as prepared by the state law driver for it.
I didn't have my hand up higher earlier. Mine is just a small question, Chairperson, which I didn't hear coming up and needed clarification. It's on the pricing in Pillar 2. I was studying the economic capital versus risk under Pillar 2, Basel, Pivotal, Pillar 2. And looking at the comments made by the National Treasury and the documentation provided. Now, the two the things I would like to clarify, issues to a person, are one in which it acknowledges that there could be bank-specific risk factor risk. And in the other, what Basel II has referred to as the economic risk, which National Treasury is divided into A and B. And then the reference to staff providing the guidance to avoid any misunderstanding of the capital requirements. Now, I haven't really heard that spelled out, and it's not really very clear in the documentation provided. Do you, Chairman, could get just a further explanation on that?
Thank you very much for the question. It's actually very good one. It's essentially saying that in Pillar 2 there is the add-on for economic risk, and that is split between 2A, which is for what's termed systemic risk, to capture the emerging market aspects of South Africa. This is a large thing. And then there's Pillar 2B, which is bank-specific risks. And what the National Treasury assessment says is that through the survey of the banks and in discussions with the banks, some of the questions that arise are, how does one distinguish between the systemic risks and the bank-specific risks? Now, there is a requirement in the legislation that says that the regulator, in applying that, must be transparent. They must disclose what their criteria are that they're using. And the other point to note is that the legislation, per se, just provides the enabling provision to implement the Basel II approach. So, in fact, some of these discussions around what is going to be in Pillar 2A or Pillar 2B are still under debate because they will come through in terms of the regulation. And my understanding is there are still some debates going on around those issues. But and those issues have yet to be finalized. But there's a broad comment is that certainly from the National Treasury viewpoint, the sense is that whatever the outcome is, it needs to be very transparent and evident what the logic or the criteria that we use in doing so, so that the banks can understand what the rationale was and that it's transparent to everybody, being the banks, the regulators, the legislature, the market analysts. But I will suggest asking Mr. Carl Rutherford from the Reserve Bank, who's heading up the Basel II project, to perhaps provide an update on where some of those discussions are around the Pillar 2A and 2B split.
Mr. Chairman, through you. If I can start by saying the following, namely that one of the important underlying concepts to Basel II is to ensure that the regulatory and supervisory approach that is being taken holds, is in contact with reality, that it doesn't become an intervention that is undermines economic reality, that subverts economic reality, that leads to unintended consequences, to perverse outcomes. That is why there is, in a sense, then always the touchstone of trying to understand what is economic reality and ensuring that whatever is being done on the regulatory side and the supervisory side does comply with those requirements. Putting that aside for a moment, under the first pillar of Basel II, three risks are being addressed, namely credit risk, market risk, and operational risk. And these risks are being quantified. There's fairly general agreement on exactly how to quantify those risks and to determine the appropriate level of capital to be held in respect of exposure to those risks. However, there are a myriad of other risks that some intentionally are being undertaken by a bank, others the bank is inherently exposed to. And those risks also need to be catered for. Capital needs to be held against those risks as well. And Pillar 2 is then the receptacle for the balance of the risk. So the two essentially cover three broad categories of risks. The one is risks considered under Pillar 1, but that are not fully captured under Pillar 1. Secondly, risks that are not catered for under Pillar 1. And then, thirdly, factors external to the bank. So that's the pot that you've got to deal with under Pillar 2. It was an approach to dealing with that is then to say, okay, which of these risks are systemic in nature and affect all banks? And let's package that into a particular component, a module, and we call that the Pillar 2A add-on, the systemic risk add-on, that caters for the whole system. Then you have a second category, those risks that are idiosyncratic to the particular institution, that only apply to that institution, they're unique to that institution. Those idiosyncratic risks are then being catered for under what is being called Pillar 2B. So that a bank would then be required under Pillar 1 to hold capital for credit loss and operational risk, and under Pillar 2 for the balance. And as has been stated, it should be a transparent process. There is a substantial body of knowledge being built up and being developed within the Bank Supervision Department to ensure that that process is as objective and scientifically responsible as possible and as transparent as possible, so that whatever decisions are made there, the bank would understand why the Bank Supervision came to those decisions. Furthermore, this one additional aspect is to ensure that one does not double count, because it's potentially possible under Pillar 2A to have a capital requirement for a particular issue, and under Pillar 2B to have a similar requirement. But we are very sensitive to ensure that we do not double count the capital. So we want a sound banking system with adequate capital, but not excessive capital. Capital is a scarce resource and it must be applied in the best manner possible.
In the absence of further questions, I move on to read the motion of denial of revision. And that in the opinion of the Portfolio Commission of Finance, legislation is desirable to amend the Bank Act 1990 so as to require no further defiance than is present. Give certain provisions to controlling companies, to clarify certain provisions in line with their practical application, to update references to legislation and institutions, to delete outdated provisions, to provide for the roles and responsibilities of the consolidation supervisor and their host supervisor, to provide for written arrangements related to the respective roles and responsibilities of the cooperation between supervisors, to provide for the sharing of information, to provide for the supervisory review process, to provide for the mapping of external ratings, to provide for the issuance of sectional directions and guidance, to provide for the publication of registration and deregistration of branches, controlling companies and representative offices, and to provide clarity with regard to the registration of a controlling company, to provide for the calculation of the amount pertaining to the restriction of investment by controlling companies, to prescribe by regulation, to clarify provisions relating to the establishment of a subsidiary by a bank, to amend the provision pertaining to the transfer of assets and liabilities by a bank, to extend a provision regarding the minimum share capital and unimpaired reserve funds of the bank, to extend the provisions pertaining to the issue of certain financial instruments, to provide for the approval of eligible, to provide for the verification of information, to increase the powers of the registrar and duly appointed manager in respect of and instruction of their citizens on public taxation, and to provide for penalties that may be on the expenditures of imposed on banks by the register, and finally to provide for better connections. I wish there could be an appreciation of some of this. Unfortunately, there is. And then the report. Portfolio Committee on Finance has considered and examined the Bank Amendment Bill on the 12th of 2007. Based on Assembly Section 25, referred to it as classified by the auditing mechanism as a Section 75 bill. Reports the bill with amendments. With amendments, because there's something on the This is therefore. Thanks, members, for being so efficient that we actually now are actually struggling to find something to do on the 19th, because this formal configuration was duplicated on the 19th because we plan to have the hearing on the 10th, which is the tradition of this institution that we are now for stage 4 engagement. But since there were no takers, there was gentlemen concerned. As you can see in the commentary, and also in the negotiation of the kind of legislation. So, that gives us a bit of time on our hands, and we are struggling to find something to do on the 19th. I think the creative bias of these two gentlemen here, we are going to find something. Because I think it is very unfair for members. For members not to have a committee meeting on the issue. Thanks, and then Treasury, thanks for coming to the meeting very much. Thank you so much, realization of the session.
Thank you very much, dear, and thank you very much, honorable members.
Therefore, are going to try and meet on this. We're working hard. This brings us to the end of this meeting, and we may continue to enjoy the rest of the day.